here. I will call the hearing back in session in docket HP09-001. That's TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP and their application for a construction permit to construct the Keystone XL pipeline in western South Dakota. Prior to recess, TransCanada, the applicant, was in the progress of putting on its direct case. And at this point, I will call on Mr. Kennecke or his co-counsel to call their next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Keystone calls Heidi Tilquist to the stand.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
It's even brighter now. Okay, it's on. It was a blonde moment.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
My name's Heidi Tilquist.
Where do you live?
I live in Fort Collins, Colorado.
What's your business address?
1601 Prospect Parkway.
What is your role with the Keystone XL pipeline project?
I work as a contractor with AECOM for TransCanada. I've been doing a pipeline risk assessment for them for the last several years.
You filed.
Excuse me once, Mr. Moore. I'm sorry. Could you please, Heidi, pull the mic a little closer to you?
Absolutely.
Again, these are very, they really require you to be close.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You submitted pre-filed direct testimony in this case, correct?
Yes, I did.
And you have that before you marked as Exhibit 12?
Yes.
And are there any changes or corrections to the testimony before you that is marked as Exhibit 12?
No.
If you were asked all the questions that are contained in that testimony today, would you give all the same answers?
Yes, I would.
Ms. Tilquist, there was, in paragraph 10 of your direct testimony, testimony about the chance of a spill occurring in South Dakota once in every 7,400 years for any particular one-mile segment of the pipeline. That figure is different from the figure that was contained in your initial testimony in this case before it was changed. Could you just explain to the commission in general what occurred there?
Well, we calculated the risk of a spill based on the PHMSA database, which is basically an incident database for all the hazardous liquid pipelines. And then we used modification factors based on best professional judgment of many of TransCanada's engineers. When we first did the risk assessment, we calculated that value of 8,400 years. When we did a series of Q&As, both internally within AECOM, TransCanada's, some of their contractors, and actually the gentleman, Kurt Melbaum, that wrote the pipeline risk assessment book, they all found it adequate. They were fine with it. But when I looked at the number, the 8,400, and how it was derived, it's broken down into several different factors: corrosion, excavation damage, geological hazards, hydraulic events, and materials. The corrosion value that we had after we had taken the baseline PHMSA database and modified it, it had dropped down in the ranking compared to the way the original PHMSA database would be. To be true to the PHMSA database, which again is historical data, it's based on a much older pipe, but corrosion and excavation tend to be the top two major causes of pipeline incidences. With this re-ranking, with these application factors, it had dropped it down to the point where I felt it wasn't being true to historical data. Now, the engineers feel that they were extremely conservative in their adjustment factors, In fact, they feel that the adjustment factors were still probably off by a factor of an order of magnitude or two. Nevertheless, you know, the purpose of my work is to be extremely conservative. So I adjusted the risk up, so a greater chance of it occurring, to hold true to the historical data, to remain so that we're basically, again, overestimating the risk of an event.
Could you just explain for the commissioners what the PHMSA database is?
The PHMSA database is data collected by PHMSA. The most recent database starts in 2002 to present. It categorizes if an operator has a spill of over 5 gallons or various other criteria, they have to report it to PHMSA. And PHMSA collects a variety of data about each of these spills. So it's a pretty powerful database, and it allows us to analyze a lot of information about pipelines and pipeline incidences. The thing that you need to note is that the majority of pipeline, over 60% of the pipeline, is built before the 1970s. So before we have FPE coating and cathodic protection, a lot of the things that we consider standard practice now in the inline inspections, a lot of pipe hadn't had that done. So the database tends to be, again, extremely conservative when you try to apply it to a new pipeline because so much of the pipe is old with old standards compared to this new pipe that we're putting into the ground.
So is it fair to say that you adjust the historical data based on current pipeline construction and operations practices that would affect the likelihood of a spill?
That is correct.
And in doing the calculation that you did that resulted in a spill once every 7,400 years for any one-mile segment of the pipeline, do you overestimate or underestimate risk in your calculation?
The whole point of the risk assessment is to try to overestimate the chance of an event happening. That gives the decision makers a good chance of, they have some bounds. So if I say a spill is no more than once in every 7,400 years, we don't expect it to occur for any given mile, but we don't expect it to occur at that frequency. We would actually expect it to be much less, but it does provide a conservative estimate.
Also, in paragraph 10 of your updated direct testimony, you indicate that the size of that spill is likely to be 3 barrels or less. What is the basis for that determination?
Again, going back to the PHMSA database, they have a lot of data that's available to analyze. One of the columns that they have is the amount of material lost in a hazardous liquid spill. We calculated statistics. Now I'm going to try to explain this. The median spill size is 3 barrels. Now, there's different ways of explaining an average. There's a median and a mean. The median is an average where 50% of the spills will be smaller and 50% will be larger. So the 3-barrel spill represents the median value. So 50% of the spills will be smaller than 3 barrels, 50% will be larger. The mean value is when we sum up all of the spills and then divide by the number of total spills. That gives us a mean spill size of 296. The reason that those numbers are so different is because the data is skewed. There's many, many very small spills, and then there's a couple outlier points, and that pulls the mean value to a greater value. So we express a lot of times the median value because that gives a person an idea of, most of the time it's going to be this size.
In looking at the PHMSA database, were you able to obtain historical data about the size of spills not detected within the first 2 days of the occurrence of the spill?
Yes, we did. We looked at, again, they have a time to detection with the spill volume. The mean value is 527. The median, so again, the 50%, is 15 barrels. So spills, even if they didn't detect it within the first 48 hours, most of them are 15 barrels or less.
And were you able to determine from the historical data in the PHMSA database the percentage of spills detected within 7 days?
Yes. The number of spills detected within 7 days is 97%.
That's all the questions I have, and I tender the witness for cross-examination.
Thank you, Mr. Blackburn.
Stilchrist, you've testified that there's a median and a mean spill. Do the regulations that, of which you're aware, I assume you're familiar with the regulations that govern, that regulate spill emergency response planning, for example?
I'm fairly familiar.
Do those regulations regulate for the median spill?
The, if you're talking about spill, the 194, part 194, talks about the maximum spill volume.
Right.
That's what they plan for.
And do the, so the regulations also don't plan for the mean spill either?
No.
So your testimony today here is therefore not directly relevant to how this body or any other body should, or the federal government regulates actual spills, or what they're prepared, what the planning should be related to those spills.
No, I wouldn't agree with the way you've stated that. The risk assessment that we do, this is a baseline assessment. We use it for NEPA planning purposes. We use it for design for replacement of valves. But we also use it to begin the integrity management planning program. That is covered in federal regulations. It gives us an idea of where we need to be concerned about, and it gives us an idea by looking at things like the mean and the median volumes. It gives us an idea of what to expect. However, again, when we go back to our response plans and for our planning purposes, we will use the maximum spill volume to ensure that we have sufficient personnel and equipment to cover that maximum spill volume.
So your testimony here wouldn't have any effect on the quantity, quality, or availability of materials or equipment to respond to spills?
My testimony wouldn't have any.
Would TransCanada adjust its spill response efforts based on an assessment of the median or the median or mean spill volume?
No, the TransCanada will plan for the maximum spill volume.
No further questions. Thank you.
Ms. Semler.
Excuse me. I have some questions about the impaired streams that will be affected by the pipeline. I think I've got the right witness, or no?
It probably was not me.
Okay.
Sorry. And I'm more dealing with the spills.
Yeah. We can clarify it in other ways. So no questions from staff right now.
Commissioners, do you have questions? Thank you, Ms. Hamler. Commissioners, do you have questions of Ms. Telquist? Commissioner Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Telquist, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Appreciate your past testimony before us on the Keystone line. A moment ago, as Mr. Moore was asking you questions and you were explaining, either my ears didn't hear right or you misspoke, because your written testimony says one spill in every 7,400 years. And I thought I heard you say, as you were chatting, you said, excuse me, testifying, you said 8,400 years.
My original testimony that,
yes,
I filed had one in 8,400 years. And then we did an updated revised testimony.
Oh, okay.
So what you have as my exhibit has the one, no more than one in 7,400.
Okay, so as I was multitasking, I heard correctly. I just didn't hear the proper reference. Thank you. I wanted to make certain I had the right. Now, when we talk about once in every 7,400 years in any given mile, my son was a lot better with calculus than I, and statistics and such, but how does that change when we're dealing with a couple hundred miles going through the state of South Dakota? What's the likelihood of a spill in South Dakota on a couple hundred miles?
Well, you would take this, the frequency occurrence that we have generated, and you can convert it. So this is per mile. There are 313 miles, I believe, of pipe in South Dakota. If you did the same type of occurrence frequency calculation, you would come up with one spill, no more than one spill, every 24 years for South Dakota.
So there's a chance of a spill in South Dakota once every 24 years?
Again, and that's based on a very conservative assessment that we did. We would not expect, it's not TransCanada's expectation that that would be the occurrence frequency. It would be much less, but that is the value we calculated to give, again, decision makers some basis of information.
Sure.
It's kind of a worst case scenario.
Understood. And understanding this is, at least for me, is one of the most important parts of the whole component is the health and safety. I think everything is surrounds it. Economic development's important, et cetera. But it seems like the pipeline itself, from a standpoint of health and safety of the citizens, all surrounds whether there's a likelihood of any sort of release. The ERP is going through a process of development at the present time. And I don't know if we're going to see that prior to the statutory requirement for us to make a decision. I would anticipate that we won't. However, if we don't, would it be wrong for us to rely upon the Keystone ERP as at least a barometer of what, since you worked on that, I assume you can answer that question.
I actually did not work on
oh.
the ERP,
okay.
But my, you know, as you heard Mr. Hayes testify, the majority of the ERP that KXL, Keystone XL will be based on, the majority is based on the Keystone template. So it would give you a good gauge.
So would I be wrong to rely upon that as somewhat of a...
My personal opinion?
Yes.
Is I would say that it would be fair to use that as a guide. Yeah.
Thank you. In your testimony, you also state that approximately 1% of the pipeline incidents are attributed to ground motion. Surprisingly enough, we have had some earthquakes, actually, in South Dakota, albeit small, but... what's the likelihood of ground motion? And I also understand it's interesting. You drive down the interstate and you see the see hills in a variety of areas that have just fallen down, and you can see the lines of where they have collapsed upon themselves. What's the potential of that happening?
Well, I think you addressed the potential based on historical data. Again, including the older pipe, it's a small fraction of the events. We did account for ground motion as a hazard to the pipeline in our risk assessment. The interesting thing is that a lot of the area in South Dakota is classified by the by PHMSA. They do a kind of a national map, so very, very broad. But a lot of Western South Dakota was classified as having landslide potential. So we actually increased the risk in our risk assessment due to that. We tried to overestimate the number of spills we would see. Now, in actuality, again, that was at a macro level that they, these maps were generated at. I was personally involved with the routing. And when we would route this pipeline, as you said, there's a lot of places where the slopes are steep and they tend to slough off. We a lot mainly try to stay up on these plateaus where the there were much more stability, and try to avoid side slopes or steep slopes coming off the hillsides. I know that there was in some of the open houses some concerns of some people that had mentioned this particular area. We think the slope is pretty unstable. I know Keystone had somebody out within like a day or two, and actually they engineered that whole site based on the information they got from the landowner. So it's something to consider. It's a risk. Modern pipe is just a lot more robust than older pipe, but it's still a hazard, and we consider it very, very strongly in our assessments.
What's the survivability of pipe in that type of a situation?
I think modern pipe has been shown to be very robust. I don't have any statistics to give you on that. But I know like in earthquakes, I mean, they actually plan for those types of movements. In California, they've got hundreds of miles of pipeline, and they can actually adjust for those types of things. Sloughing and things certainly could affect a pipe. If ground motion like that were to occur, Keystone is required by federal regulations to actually go out and inspect the area to see if there is any damage to the pipeline. And that may consist of actually putting one of these geometric pegs into the pipeline to see if there was any deformation of the pipe, let alone any leaks or anything. So they'll be going out there and looking at it to make sure that the integrity of the pipe is still intact.
Thank you. In your testimony, you also state that groundwater contamination would tend to be localized within a few hundred feet of the spill site. You also state in another portion of your testimony that the pipeline itself and in working would be important to minimize the risk to public surface water resources. Do you have, based upon your own personal position, what you would consider outside of what has been presented to us, what you believe is the right distance to have this pipeline from a public water source, such as someone's well on their farm or ranch or wells for a community?
Well, there was a study done. Actually, it was a series of five or six studies that were combined. Five or six studies combined. They looked at over 500 sites where they looked at BTEX, which is the soluble components of concern in crude oil. And the mobility in groundwater. And they found that in over 90% of the cases, you have the spill occurs over time. It's not the crude oil that moves, but it's the dissolved constituents that come out of the oil and that can migrate with the groundwater. What they found was that the constituents 90% of the time were limited to about 300 feet away from the actual source site. What does that mean as far as, what's a safe distance? It's hard to quantitate, but I would say that even if you put a well that was right next to the pipeline, and if a spill occurred in that area, and if it got into the groundwater, and if it got to the concentration that was high enough to cause problems, there is regulations that require that TransCanada would have to provide an alternative water source. Again, because it's so localized, the effects, we can also know which way the groundwater is moving. The Keystone may, that they're as I said, they have to provide an alternative water source. They may end up drilling another well within a few hundred feet just next to it, but upstream of the groundwater movement, and they have an alternative water supply. So there is mechanisms in place even if something were to occur.
In your written testimony as well as in your oral testimony today, you've stated within a few hundred feet. Few always means 300 to me. What does it mean to you?
If I didn't say, what I meant to say was 90% of the cases, the spill was within approximately 300 feet of the source oil.
Would I be right or wrong to change or to interpret, in your testimony on paragraph on 13, your answer to 13, when you said groundwater contamination would tend to be localized within a few hundred feet of the spill? Would I be wrong to assume you meant 300?
That would work.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sorry. That would be a yes.
Thank you. We speak the same language, which is not legally, so. Thank you. Also, you state crude oil floats on the water's surface. This is in your written testimony on 14. Crude oil floats on the water's surface, providing the opportunity for Keystone to detect, contain, and clean up the crude oil before long-term environmental impacts occur. As in your oral testimony today, I'm sure you'll agree, you spoke of the dissolved contaminants. So as I read that sentence, should I feel as safe about it as I did the first time I read it?
First of all, let me go back and find it because I was still trying to find it. So,
if you look under 14,
yeah,
about the 1-3-4th paragraph, second sentence from the...
I got it. Okay. Okay, so what I would say about crude oil floating on the surface water...
You're saying there's an opportunity there for...
Yes.
How much of an opportunity? Basically, let me get a little more direct to what I'm asking, and that is, how much time is there before these dissolved contaminants, isn't that fairly immediate before they start to...
That would depend on environmental conditions. What we assume for our risk analysis is that we basically took all the oil and basically shook it up in the water system, and that's how we evaluated our toxicity. That never happens. In real life, I mean, what you would have is things like turbulence. So if you were on a windy day where it might stir up, you might increase the surface of the oil's contact with water. So you might increase the ability of the oil, the dissolved constituents to get out. Temperature is a factor. There's a number of different factors. But it's not an instantaneous thing by any means. And as a matter of fact, most of the chemicals that have water solubility, these BTEX compounds that we talk about, most of them have a greater affinity to the oil than they do to the water itself. So you have an oil spill spreading out on the surface of the water. The biggest the weathering process is the evaporation of these BTEX compounds. They are highly volatile, so they tend to evaporate faster than they're going to dissolve into the water. The other thing I would add is that of 69 compounds that they examined within crude oil, it was only benzene that had the ability to solubilize into water to a concentration that it would exceed the maximum contaminant level. So it's a drinking water standard. So it takes time. The evaporation is going to be a bigger factor than the dissolving rate. So certainly it does allow the emergency crews time to react.
And groundwater would be subjected differently than surface water.
That's right. So groundwater, again, the spill is going to have to start penetrating through the soil to however deep the groundwater is. It'll pool on the surface of the groundwater. during this penetration phase and while it's beginning to pool on the surface of groundwater, you know, cleanup crews can be, you know, trying to excavate and remove this. What you will find is that there, if oil is left over, if it stays there for a length of time, that's when it's the dissolved constituents can get out and start moving with the groundwater. But they tend to move more slowly than the groundwater because of natural attenuation.
In your testimony, you spoke of appropriate remedial measures. Would that include monitoring wells? And I won't, it's in the same paragraph as what we were referring to before, but it's towards the end, but it's referring to the event, if an event took place, that appropriate remedial actions would take place. Would that include paying for monitoring wells so that if it were groundwater, be able to ascertain or draw the liquid out, but certainly downstream have monitoring wells so that any progression of the contaminant would be found, discovered?
What would happen if a spill occurred and there was, we suspected that there was groundwater contamination. Well, the spill occurred, the South Dakota DENR would be notified. If the groundwater contamination was suspected, then sampling would need to occur. So monitoring wells would be likely installed. Again, this would be at Keystone's cost. They're responsible for their cleanup. And then based on what they were finding, what the results of those were, they would work with the state agency to determine what type of remediation process would be appropriate. Sometimes remediation can, you know, when you dig up or do, you know, things can cause a lot more damage. So they would work with people like Kim McIntosh with the state to come up with what remediation process is appropriate and the cleanup levels that they will be held to.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Colbeck, questions?
Hi, Heidi.
Hey.
On question, I guess it'd be number 8 of your direct testimony, it said that your analysis of the FEMSA pipeline indicated database indicated that fire occurred on approximately 2% of the pipelines. Is this crude oil, or does that include natural gas and refined petroleum?
The FEMSA database is based on hazardous, that I analyzed, is based on hazardous liquids. So it includes refined products, things like diesel and things like that. So it's more inclusive than just crude oil.
Okay. Would you classify refined petroleum as more or less hazardous than crude oil?
That's a difficult question to ask. I would say there is refined products have a greater chance for acute toxicity, greater chances for exceedances of water quality standards, but they also will have generally lower persistence in the environment. So crude oil, again, has some persistent compounds, so that's why cleanup, emergency response and then cleanup is important, particularly important for crude oil.
Okay, well, and we know it's important, but I guess I'm a little confused as to, does refined petroleum penetrate the ground more than a crude oil?
Refined products tend to be have less viscosity. So, yes, they would penetrate soils much more quickly.
Okay. So how about natural gas? Would natural gas be considered more flammable than crude oil?
But yes.
So the 2%, that number.
Let me just clarify.
Oh,
natural gas is not even in this database. There's a whole separate database for natural gas.
Okay.
So this has natural gas liquids like, you know, heptanes and things like
that.
But natural gas, methane is a separate database.
Okay. So we've got We've got basically BTEC based fuels in this 2%, or
That is included in there. But there's also things like CO2 pipelines are actually considered liquid pipelines. Ammonia can be transported. Okay. There is just a litany of things. I would say the vast majority of materials transported are petroleum products.
Okay.
So,
of those products that are in that study, do you know where the flash point or where the ignition point would be for crude oil compared to the other ones?
I'd have to look that up. We could provide that if you needed that information.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering, we've got a group of substances and we come up with 2%. I'm just wondering, is crude oil the most flammable of the 2% or the least flammable of the 2%?
I would suggest that the crude oil that would be transported, knowing the BTEX content, is it's close to 1%, 1.5%. So, again, those are the highly volatile compounds that would tend to quickly ignite, given the low content compared to, say, in gasoline, which would be, maybe closer to, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to guess here, but maybe 25% or something. It would be much more flammable. The refined products would be more flammable. Crude oil would be much less likely to catch on fire.
Okay.
You'd have a very difficult time in some cases to get the crude oil ignited.
Okay. The potential impacts on the sensitive species and your testimony, did you find anything unusual in South Dakota? Any species that maybe you would highlight for us or think that we should take into special consideration?
No. Again, I was brought in very early in this process, and it's really unusual to be brought in, for somebody like me to be brought in during routing. But the benefits is that we can route around a lot of these high consequence areas, places where ecologically sensitive animals might be. So literally when we were flying the route and drawing these maps, we were overlaying these high consequence areas, including these ecologically sensitive areas, over the map so we could try to avoid to the greatest extent possible impacts to those areas. So the amount of high consequence areas that we impact on this project, it would be much lower than you would see on a typical project, just because TransCanada got this risk assessment done early in the process.
Okay. Does the vegetation, obviously, in the area that you're going through, I would consider somewhat unique. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, I think every place is unique, but it's not. There are other places. Many of these same types of environments can be found. But I mean, like the sandhills. I mean, that's a fairly. I wouldn't say unique, but it would have unique characteristics.
Sure. And you've helped permit over 5,000 miles of pipeline, so you're familiar with the situation and you're comfortable with going through the sandhills in South Dakota?
Yeah, we've actually I've done work doing same types of risk assessments. We did work down as an example. For a pipeline for Shell, and that went through some sand hill type areas around Jal, New Mexico. And that had some T&E species, some lizards associated with it. And, so we did the same methodology that's used in the risk assessments and the studies that I do for Keystone is exactly the same thing. I usually work for the government side, so it's the same methodology is used for the BLM or the Forest Service. They looked at the analysis for that pipeline, and they were, they said, yeah, this is acceptable.
Okay. You mentioned that 7 days detected is 97%. Could you explain that a little bit more?
So in the PHMSA database, they have a column where it's they report time to detection. Now, Well, so we took the data, we analyzed it, and we just said, okay, in 7 days, how many spills are detected? If you do a percentile analysis, the number is 97%.
What happens to the other 3%?
The most spills, of the remaining spills, the longest in the database, the longest time to detect a spill, I have to look at my little sheet here, was 78 days. What is interesting to note is that spill was only consisted of 636 barrels. So it doesn't necessarily equate that a longer time to detection equates with a huge release. In fact, this 78 days was probably a very small, slow drip that occurred.
Sure. So it's been your experience that if there's a lot of oil leaking out of the pipeline, you're going to have a much quicker response time?
Yes.
Okay. So this 638 barrels over 78 days, that would not be detectable? Or would a leak like that become larger and larger over time?
It becomes large. Well, so you have a pinhole leak, and so it's dripping really slowly. And so, as you can imagine, it would start to it starts contaminating a little area, and then it starts percolating up through the soils and along in the pipeline trench. We have aerial surveillance that flies by. So what they might have seen is they may have seen discoloration of the soil as the oil was coming up. What they might have seen, if it was a heavily vegetated area, is suddenly some vegetation starts yellowing. There's a lot of keys. These folks that do the aerial surveillance are trained to look for certain things. So aerial surveillance could have picked it up. I don't know who picked it up. It could have been a landowner that, was out. Maybe it was in the range and they came out and smelled something and reported it. But that was the longest one that was in the database.
Okay. And that actually goes to the mean and medium, like you were saying, that the days are long, but the barrels are low, so that's why there's two different...
Yeah, it's...
Okay.
Yeah.
As far as the crude oil that goes through the pipeline, is there any difference in a Canadian crude oil compared to Texas crude oil?
I'll give you a mixed answer. Every crude oil is unique. However, the crude oil, and that's just because of the geological formations it comes out of, and it's got hundreds of literally thousands of compounds within each oil. However, these crude oils are very, very comparable to oils that we find in certain parts of California, Venezuela, Nigeria, Russia. So they're not unique.
But as far as a fusion bond epoxy pipe and corrosion, in your opinion, would one corrode faster than the other? If you're hauling Texas crude oil north or Canadian crude oil south, with those two pipelines, would one corrode faster than the other?
I'm not sure if I have the expertise to answer that question for you.
Okay. Some of the landowners had questions, I guess, and I just explained my question. I had thought that maybe Canadian oil was different than Texas oil or out of the Bakken formation in mm-hmm. North Dakota. Do you know if it's similar to that oil? Do you know if it's similar to the Bakken formation?
I do not know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. When you say that if there was a small pinhole leak, it would bubble up in the trench, is that the same behavior of a refined petroleum? Or would refined petroleum go to the bottom of the trench and down?
Well, it's going to do a little bit of all. Typically what happens is with a spill, it tends to stay in the pipeline trench because no matter how well they try to compact it, the pipeline trench is less consolidated than the surrounding materials. So it'll tend to spread laterally, and it'll tend to spread vertically, But there also will be penetration, you know, into the out of the trench, into the sides, and down through the soils. Those rates won't occur as fast because of the lack of consolidation.
Okay. How fast is that? Does this crude oil travel through the pipe?
I'm not an expert in that, but I've heard it's about as fast as you can walk.
Okay. So it's not like zooming as fast as like a natural gas particles or like, that's a bad example, but probably doesn't move as fast as when you pump it into your car, refined petroleum into your car.
I would say that's probably correct.
Okay. I think that's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any follow-up from you, Commissioner Hansen? Nope. I might have just a couple here. In terms of overall, in terms of percent of the line, gee, isn't that my microphone blowing up there?
We'll blame it on the microphone.
Maybe it wants me to be quiet. Would you characterize most of the area traversed by the pipeline as having groundwater formations that are vulnerable in terms of your overall experience?
I would suggest that most of the route is not sensitive to the groundwater contamination. Certainly there are portions along alluvial areas and, you know, sandy areas, but for the most part, the depth to water and the formations underlying the lithology would prevent a crude oil spill from reaching most of the groundwater.
I think that's all I have. I forgot, Mr. Moore, was that you that was conducting the direct?
It was, and I have no additional questions.
Okay. In response to the commissioner questions, is there any follow-up from either of the either interveners or Ms. Semler?
If I may, just a couple of quick questions. Stilquist, are you a expert in emergency response planning?
I am not.
And have you participated in any emergency responses?
Oh, yes, I have.
How many have you participated in?
Just one.
Okay. Have you reviewed the Keystone system template for the emergency response plan?
I have not.
So therefore, you wouldn't know whether it includes any site-specific or state-specific information in it about location of materials, location of personnel, or any other detailed information?
I can tell you that let me retract, I guess, what I first answered. I have seen the document. I have, you know, flipped through it, but I didn't examine it, you know, in depth for the Keystone line. And there was state-specific information, but I didn't examine it at all in detail. I just literally said, mm-hmm. I didn't spend any time.
And you referred to it as a template, not as a draft, right?
I'm sorry, I was referring to the Keystone ERP that I looked at.
Yes, and you referred to that as a template?
No, that they will use much of the information that's in the Keystone PHMSA-approved ERP. They'll use much of that same information for the Keystone XL plan.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Semler? Do you have any responsive questions?
Nothing
Mr.
else.
Mr. Blackburn, thank you. I think that's it then, Ms. Tolquist. You're excused. Applicant, how are you doing here, Sherry? Are you okay? Keystone, call your next witness. Okay.
The only witness we have left in our direct case is Secretary Oster for tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Okay.
Mr. Smith?
Mm-hmm.
Staff does have a few housekeeping items we could possibly take care of if we do have some extra time.
Okay. So at this point, then, I'm understanding, then, Keystone, your case is going to rest until tomorrow morning, and we'll have the one witness, and then that's it for your direct case.
That's correct.
Okay. Staff, fire away.
Well, I guess the easiest one to start with would be staff did submit pre-filed testimony and some supplemental testimony, if the parties would stipulate to that, as we did to TransCanada's pre-filed testimony. Staff would make that request. Next would be, because this has gone so much faster than we anticipated, staff does need some time to prepare for tomorrow, and we'd ask that the time, the start time tomorrow morning, be moved back 9:30. Finally, we have several witnesses that are unable to be here until Thursday, and the parties have all agreed that they could participate telephonically. We'd ask that be approved by the commission as well.
Okay. I guess first I'll ask the other parties if you have comments or concerns with any of that.
Well, we're certainly willing to stipulate to the staff testimony. We just think it probably should be in a list as we put ours together, and we'll do it at that time. And it's probably the cleanest. Is that what you're thinking, Mrs. Sumner?
I can have that list together right away, first thing tomorrow morning.
I don't know Secretary Oster's availability at 9:30, but I can check. I know he was unavailable any other day this week, so I will check on that. I have otherwise no objection to starting at 9:30 that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And finally, we have no objection to examining staff's witnesses by telephone should that be necessary.
Okay. Mr. Blackburn?
No objections.
Okay. Pending Mr. Kaneki checking with your witness, and I forgot Oster's availability at a time other than 8:30, I guess. What is the commissioner's thoughts about 9:30? I mean, I think staff is sort of been ambushed here a little bit. I don't want to use that in a negative way, but I mean, this hasn't gone quite like we all thought. So to me, it's reasonable to give them at least some extra time to prepare.
No, I think that's very reasonable.
Absolutely. There was no way for staff to anticipate this, so
right.
Certainly no intent to ambush or anything of that nature. It's from the standpoint that things progress rather quickly, and I would say that that's due to the pre-filed testimony and the fact that we have covered this type of ground before, and so it's to expedite it makes all the sense in the world to give staff that opportunity. Yes.
Great. Okay. Well, with that, then I'm going to, on the record here, so we're lawful about it, then we are going to, when we recess today, we're going to recess until 9:30 in the morning in lieu of the originally scheduled 8:30. Unless we hear that the only time when Mr. Oster can be available is at 8:30. Because honestly, if he could be available at any time tomorrow, right, Mr. Kaneki, that would suffice, would it not?
Yes, that's exactly right. His testimony isn't chronologically important.
Mm-hmm.
To ours, or frankly to anybody else's, of which I'm aware. And as soon as I find out, I'll telephone you and let the parties know as well.
Okay. Subject to that caveat, we will resume when we do recess here today at 9:30 a.m. Tomorrow morning. Does that take care of your issues then, Ms. Semler, then?
The final one was whether we could take testimony from some out-of-state witnesses via telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that there'll be any cross, but in the event there is, we'd prefer to do it via telephone so they aren't required to change travel arrangements, and it creates complications.
Right. Yeah, I don't, I mean, the parties seem to be, I mean, amenable to that, as I understand it, both Mr. Blackburn and...
That's correct.
I know in the past, on a few occasions, in general, the commission has not liked to do that because of just difficulties we've had sometimes managing examination over the phone, honestly. But with the one thing we have done in the past when we've done that is, the other thing is by the witness being here in South Dakota, of course, and taking an oath, they are then within the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota, and that oath makes them come under our statutes related to the taking of an oath, among them culpability for perjury. And we have asked witnesses in the past to stipulate over the phone that they are in agreement, that they are in effect testifying within the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota and subject to all of our laws related to the taking of an oath and the sanctions that occur with respect thereto. So, okay, Ms. Semler, that we might want to communicate that to them.
And I don't anticipate any issues with that. That's okay. Acceptable.
Right. I mean, I would have to say in most of these kind of cases, the testimony usually is opinion testimony, and it tends more to be being wrong or than lying in general anyway, and I think so. The risk of that's quite minimal. Well, I don't know. In terms of today, then, Mr. Blackburn, I had a brief discussion prior to the commencement of the hearing today. And do you want to bring up now your issues with respect to your case, or do you want to commence a case in chief? And as I understand it, basically that, if I'm getting it right, and please jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, that what you really had were a couple of exhibits that you wanted to try to have admitted, either on a judicial notice basis or maybe on a stipulated basis. Would you like to address that now, or should we take a quick break so you can organize your thoughts, or what do you think?
It won't be just a couple, it'll be more okay. than that, more exhibits than that. What I'd like to do this afternoon is prepare that list. I have it partially prepared and haven't had a chance to finish it. And then tomorrow I can share it with the parties and they can see whether it's acceptable or not. I believe it, most of them, if not all of them, will be because they're documents provided by TransCanada or available from other jurisdictions or generally in the public domain.
Okay.
So assuming that those are acceptable, we can probably handle it fairly quickly tomorrow.
Okay. And you were going to prepare a list and then get together with counsel for the other two counsel and...
That's correct.
And see if you can work something out. Okay.
Yeah. It's nearly done. I just had a couple of last things I need to check on before I distribute it.
Sure. Well, then I think maybe in order so that both Mr. Blackburn, again, we're way ahead of schedule here, and Ms. Semler can get their presentations ready. Is there any objection to our just going into recess now, and you guys can get to work, and we'll be ready to proceed in the morning?
No objection.
Okay. Other parties?
No objection.
Okay, then it's about 2:30. We're in recess then in docket HP09-001. The hearing will come back to order at 9:30 in the morning, barring the problem with witness Oster. Thank you, everyone.